Hi everybody, this is Michael Kollo, the Curious Quant. Today I'll be speaking with Christina Chi. And Christina is a fascinating character who runs a high-frequency fund in Boston. And as a woman in the hedge fund space, specifically in high frequency, it's fascinating to get her insights on what that industry looks like from a kind of a social element to how much secrecy there is and how much misconceptions there are about the industry. From a technical basis, we'll be talking a bit more about the advent of artificial intelligence, the methodologies, the data sets, and how, if at all, this has kind of impacted that industry as it kind of goes through its own set of consolidations and changes. And currently, I suppose today, how is high frequency competing or doing what it's doing? So a really interesting conversation. I'd love for you to join us. Hi, everybody. This is The Curious Quant. And I'm here today with Christina Chi, who's my guest here joining me from the US. Hi, Christina.
Thank you for having me.
Awesome. Well, listen, I mean, before I even I start to unravel your amazing background, which I think is a kind of a someday will be worthy of a story, perhaps in a book somewhere. Tell me about how you've come to be here, sitting with me, talking here on this podcast.
Oh, man, I have such a strange background. I've realized through every time I say the background, everyone's like, what? So I guess I'll just say it and, you know, hope for the best. So I actually started a hedge fund almost nine years ago from my dorm room in college, back when I was clueless, had no experience or knowledge or money or anything, and just really wanted to combine finance and technology. And this was before fintech was a thing, so I didn't even know what fintech was. So this was like a long time ago. I didn't know what high frequency trading was. You know, that I think that term started around like 2008 or 2007. So I started this business around 2012-ish, and kind of started to just grow the company out of a dorm room until we got kicked out.
Were you taking too much of the bandwidth? Were you at the time the college was getting no Netflix or something?
Yeah, right. And they saw that we were using up all the electricity in the building, and you know, so they caught us doing a lot of crazy things. And and then after that, we were, you know, eating like ramen. I would tell people like we were eating ramen diet, you know, it was really bad. Vegetables like kale before it got it really expensive now. So we would do all this kind of stuff, and slowly and kind of really humbly grew that business, found some good investors who are still with us today, and have been able to kind of grow that business over time. So very happy to be here and be talking to you. If none of those little pieces came together, I would not be here today.
Well, I guess you'd be somewhere else and doing, I'm sure, equivalently interesting stuff. So, I mean, I suppose what I find fascinating about this story when we first talked about it is usually hear these stories which are much more corporatized about, you know, how these funds or these processes begin. And they always kind of begin with big budgets, or this notion of like an institutionalized world. But rarely have I ever heard a story about a fund that started in dorm room. Yeah, tech startups for sure, but not a fund. That usually starts somewhere in the Cayman Islands or something. You know, like there's a sense of some more institutional characteristics to that, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So I think the most prominent example in the high frequency industry is actually Citadel was started from a dorm room as well, actually. So there are some certain stories, you know, that was like 27, 28 years ago now, I think. So there's been some like success stories from dorm rooms. It's not very common, I would say. And you're absolutely right. Most people, you know, when people ask me, how do you, I want to start a fund, what should I do? I will say, you know, get an education, go to school, you know, which is like totally what I didn't do. But like, I will say something, here's a working experience, you know, go back to school, like get a lot of experience in the workplace when you've done it before. And then, you know, that's just to maximize your chances of success, of course. But of course, the people who don't listen to me are the ones who end up succeeding. And, you know, they're the ones who won't listen to anybody else. And they just started anyway. And you just kind of never know what happens. And so, I'm a very, what do you call it? Like success, the bias. What do you call it when you're successful and you have that
selection bias? I think we have a selection bias problem because you're the one here telling the story, as opposed to the other 99 Christinas who are not here telling the story where it didn't quite work out. But I mean, that's usually the case, right? People that are successful end up writing most of the time the books. So the kind of cases, if you're going to fail spectacularly, so that you can also write a book and become a speaker about that subject for the rest of your career.
Oh, absolutely. I always tell that to students as well. It's like whenever I go to schools, I'm like, you know, my whole life was like a string of failures. And like, I studied finance at MIT, you know, and that's bizarre, first off. Like, why would you go to tech school and study finance? It's because I failed out of all the other classes. And so I ended up having to choose finance, which is considered the easiest major at the school, and was a total failure for like all 4 years. And then why did I start a hedge fund? I didn't get a return offer. You know, the answer to tell investors, when investors come, I'm like, oh yeah, I wanted to combine finance and technology, you know, fintech. And then the real answer is like, I failed. I didn't get a return offer from, you know, one of the investment banks I had done trading internship at, and I felt like I had nowhere to go, and wanted to still, you know, of course still wanted to do like trading and stuff. So just did it on my own for some time. And then it turned out, you know, we got really lucky, I guess. So yeah, absolutely though. So failure's a big thing.
I think it's a really interesting and really common story that you often find in people who have kind of persevered and made it somewhere. And again, it could be a part of selection bias. But there's this notion they almost see failure is mandatory. You know, that kind of saying, you either win or you learn. And so this idea that you have to constantly keep failing in order to keep learning. So I mean, just to slip in a personal anecdote here. So when I applied for PhD programs, I was naive and I thought I was really good. And so I only applied for 10 around the world, you know, some of the biggest names. Yeah. And my supervisor at the time said, oh, you know, you better throw in this one to place called LSE, London School of Economics, because, hey, why not? And I looked at him and went, yeah, but it's not Harvard's, but all right, okay, I'll do it. And sure enough, 9 rejections later, that final acceptance from London School of Economics was the sweetest thing. Now, when you're telling the story in hindsight, you know, to, again, college or a bunch of students, you look like a rock star because you're like, yeah, and then I did my PhD in London School of Economics and like, wow. But the reality was that, you know, you kind of got in by the, you know, an inch or a hair or whatever, and you would have kept trying, but nonetheless, you know, how these things kind of come about is very small. So you're sitting here talking to me in front of this beautiful bookshelf, which looks like some kind of a multi-tiered IKEA kind of thing, but it's filled with really interesting books that I can't see from here. So I want to ask you before we start, and this goes quite high, actually. You might need a ladder for some of those. So what is your favorite book behind you?
Oh man. You know, so behind us, this is our company bookshelf. So you guys know, we have this company library with a bunch of like quant books on like from every single like quant author you could possibly imagine. I would say recently, so the book I would probably choose, I actually have it right next to me. I don't know if you've ever heard of Doing Good Better. I actually am pulling it up for you to see right now. So it's actually it's not about quant at all. I just like this book because it talks about, kind of made me think about like, how to give back actually. And how do I make if you want to make the biggest, these days, I feel like most people, millennials, et cetera, you know, we, instead of thinking about like, oh, how much money can I make in my lifetime, right? I think more people care about like, well, what difference can I make? What positive influence can I have? What legacy can I leave on the planet? And so there's this book called Doing Good Better. And there's another book that kind of is the opposite of this, but that's also kind of a similar topic of how to do good. And I totally forgot the name of it. Oh my gosh. The one by Anand, it's called like Million Dollar Something. Let me just actually Google this.
That's okay. While you're Googling it inconspicuously in the background, I was going to suggest to you that actually this is an interesting observation you have. And I actually put it down. So I used to work for a number of firms in my career. And normally when I worked for firms or teams where the average age of the people on the floor was somewhat older, so kind of a sign of a maturing industry, I suppose. Kind of mid to late 30s, early 40s, they had children, they had some perspective. Then this notion of why are we doing this? What is the ultimate point of this exercise? You know, where is this ship going? Was actually a question that we asked ourselves quite a bit. And I still think that ESG investing and some element of ESG investing took off because of the kinds of people that were in stewardship around those kinds of rooms where they said, actually, I do want to see the world a better place. I do want to make it and what I can do from my position is to kind of channel funds or money into a certain area of the economy where I think that can come about. And I sort of got an interesting hypothesis test of this idea when I was doing some work in China. Because in China, at least the companies that I was involved with, the average age was much younger. So there was a mid-20s. And there was a beautiful vitality and freshness about it and this feeling of we can do it, we can all do it, it'll be great. But the whole energy of that we can do it feeling isn't, you know, societal and rounded and thoughtful and balanced, whatever. The idea is, hey, I can do it better. I can write a better piece of code. I can use the data better. I can get more returns, etc. So I find it really interesting that the industry had matured because the average age of the people from 2009, obviously there's been less hiring, the industry is squeezed together somewhat, people have kind of stayed on their jobs, etc. So I think some of it's to do with the general profile of the person now, as opposed to the profile of the person would have been in the 80s or even 90s.
Right. Oh, for sure. You know, the culture of the workplace has changed over time as well. And every generation treats the workplace very differently too. You know, my parents' generation, right? My dad just wants to nine to five. He wants to go home. Like, a job is a job. I'm just there for the money, right? And these days, younger kids coming in the office, they're like, no, where's the free food? Where's the, you know, they expect things. They're like, oh, like, I want my career. I want, you know, meaning and other things and benefits and whatever else that I can survive and, but also do a good job and find meaning and, you know, happiness through that. So absolutely. So the book is called Winners Take All as well. So those, I think Doing It Better and Winners Take All, these are like the two really, really great contrasting books about how can you really make a difference in the world? You know, do you become a doctor and save lives, or do you go into, let's say, finance, go into quant finance and make a lot of money and donate a portion of your earnings every year? So they kind of talk about each of those paths and, you know, use some data to justify it. So would recommend checking those books out.
No, that's a really interesting one, because I said certainly when I was going through the system, the ideal was sort of retirement by 30. And obviously that was the kind of investment banking boom era. And so there's a sense of, you know, flash money, but then there's no sense of what happens after that. So there was right. a kind of emptiness, and you know, there was only kind of this idea of, oh, you have a better car or a better boat or anything like that. But I think as you go through industry, most of the time that people working in finance, they realize that, A, it's not that fast or anymore, perhaps, even if it ever was. And I think perhaps they also realize that the people that you meet, the caliber of conversations you have, it's actually quite addictive to be involved in that level of, you know, engagement information, especially with high frequency trading. So I'm gonna jump straight into that one, because I'm gonna say that generally speaking, high frequency trading is kind of a distant cousin of a lot of the quant conferences. Like, you kind of go to conferences, you meet people, you talk about stuff, and there's always somebody who doesn't quite tell you what they do and how they do it. And they always kind of give you a bit of a squint when you kind of push them on it. And not always, but a lot of the times they're kind of working in some nearby area of finance, essentially, from the mainstream people. And I often find that high frequency is one of those areas where I find it fascinating from a technology point of view, from a kind of systems, data, speed point of view. And speed is often something that quants do talk about as having an advantage over, let's say, a fundamental investor, but not to that level, usually not to that kind of microsecond level. It's usually like, oh, I can trade the markets every 5 minutes or 10 minutes. And then you get laughed out of the room in a high frequency trading shop. Okay, well, you're really slow. I'm just kind of curious about, I suppose, tell me a little bit about your experiences of being in this high frequency space and certainly the perception that you've dealt with from, you know, broader financial community or the press or whatever else, and how you've thought about this industry.
Yeah, it's certainly a strange industry. I mean, no kid grows up being like, I want to be in high frequency trading, you know, because if you look at every single movie out there, the Hummingbird Project just came out, which is about high frequency trading. I don't know if you've ever seen it. Great, you know, very funny, interesting movie. And then what else has come out? Then Flash Boys, I think, will be coming out at some point too, the movie. So there's more. I feel like there's more movies and press about HFT than the number of high frequency trading firms right now. There's not that many firms out there. So I think the surprising thing is that it's a topic that is talked about a lot, but there's just not a lot of, there's just very few companies that actually do what we do. In Boston here, I think there used to be like five or six different firms that either dabbled in high frequency or was very seriously into it. Now I think we're the only, or I'm pretty sure we're the only firm left, or one of two maybe, in Boston that's still remaining. Yeah. over time, a lot of it's because these companies fail over time. Strategies kind of come and go. You know, a lot of the strategies, because of how fast things are trading and stuff like that, you might make a lot of money really quickly, but then usually a strategy will deteriorate after, you know, even a couple of weeks, they might just deteriorate and die off. Whereas compared to like a long only fund where people are holding their positions and making one trade a month, obviously like those, you know, there's a longer term prospect for some of those types of funds. So so high frequency tends to kind of come and go. And we're at the kind of later stages of this industry in terms of things have kind of steadied off. There's been a record number of acquisitions around, you know, 2017, 2018. So a lot of mergers and acquisitions in the space. So we're at a stage now where I don't know how we somehow survived all of that. It's been interesting. And then the industry perspective in terms of like, I think it's gotten better, but there's still, you know, the general perspective of our industry, the general angle people take is still one of like, oh, I hate what you're doing and you guys are evil. And I think that that's so long as the media says stuff like that, I think that rest of the people, you know, the public will continue to think that. And that's like, I mean, that's fine. You know, there are certain high frequency firms that do buy order flow, for instance, but there's a lot of non-high frequency firms that also every single large bulge bracket bank buys order flow. So, you know, there's a lot of misconceptions that I do try to go out there and debunk those misconceptions. But a lot of it is also because you're right, like a lot of the leaders in high frequency trading, they're not public at all. They don't tell people what they do. They're super secretive. You know, they're like Renaissance doesn't do high frequency, but you know, they're kind of like Renaissance where no one has an online profile, you know, they're kind of hard to reach, you know, you don't find them, they kind of find you. So, that really does need to change, I feel like. So hopefully this will help.
Cause I think it's a fascinating thing. So the culture of quant and maybe high frequency is like an extreme example of that, is one of a little bit of a standoffish competitive nature, right? So there is a sense by which if I tell you what I'm doing, that you might be doing it as well, and therefore I won't be able to make money off it. And I sort of find it interesting in the kind of recent renaissance into data and into modeling for data science purposes, there's almost the opposite culture that's kind of sweeping in, which says, oh, we should all share our libraries and we should try to figure out exactly how much we do. So I remember being in a conversation in a quant firm where, you know, the question came up, should we share some of our non-essential libraries on GitHub? And maybe we can get feedback and impressions and we can get other people to think about it, but not the stuff that, you know, our secret juice, but all of the other, you know, enormous amounts of utility code that you write around that kind of stuff. And there was this kind of almost a shock in the room that why would you ever do that? I mean, it was clear that you couldn't lose money off it, but equally, it just went against every sort of strain of DNA of people in that room. So I find a problem with HFT, you guys obviously, as you see the new technologies coming through, both in terms of technical technology, so I suppose faster processing speeds or those type of ideas, or you see different kinds of modeling ideas coming through, like the machine learning and sort of extreme pattern recognition, which feels like it would be really good for this type of problem set. I mean, has this impacted your world at all? Did this kind of rise in both of those categories, and how so, I guess?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I guess, you know, to a certain extent, like for everyone tends to confuse high frequency trading with AI or machine learning. So we get invited to a bunch of AI talks. And the first thing we'll say is like, you know, we do use a little bit of AI for strategy selection and for certain kind of obscure strategies that we might be running where we need to kind of learn, you know, do a little bit of machine learning and that's about it. But for the most part, you know, because we're high frequency, we're latency sensitive, we need to be really fast. Right now, you know, you look at how AIs and machine learning works, it's extremely slow, just by nature of like how complicated things are. When things tend to get more complicated, they tend to get slower, and it's just too slow for the types of trading strategies that we're running. So we might use, you know, we might use it in the middle office or the back office to do certain tasks and processes, but definitely, you know, on the trading side, there's some applications, but it's relatively limited at this point. Yeah, absolutely. And then you mentioned, like, for instance, the rise of open source in recent years in this industry, I think it's been great, for sure. It's helped to kind of lower the barrier to entry for a lot of folks in the industry, which I think is really awesome. We've been able to, you know, we've done internships actually where we've had interns where we can just share with them, you know, our own technology, you know, in terms of like that'd be a huge risk to be able to share kind of that core key technologies that we're working on. But what we could do is we could say, hey, you could use this open source technology and, you know, process your own data and create your own strategy through open source stuff. And it definitely worked out that way as well. So so it's really helped a lot. And I think it's hopefully going to get better over time. There's a lot more companies coming up that are trying to do open source stuff, or not just open source, but also like crowdsourcing, like strategies and things like that. So, you know, they may have data scientists, like students, people around the world who come up with their own strategies, and then, you know, they'll trade on their platform. So there's been a lot of companies like that in recent years that have changed the industry a lot too. So
I'm a big fan of Quantopian. I had John on the podcast actually earlier. So
They pioneered that model, you know,
and that's then great. Fantastic.
It's been great because you see now there's like 100 other companies that really, you know, similar types of things using that kind of model to you know, crowdsource their algorithms, which is awesome.
The whole idea of enablement for me is really what resonated with this idea that the 7.5 billion people on this planet, so there has to be more people that can do strategies or idea generation or investment management than the ones that got right. through the Goldman Sachs interview process, right? Or, you know, Absolutely. That's the stereotype of the elite, I suppose, you know, that we kind of deal with. So I'm just curious, with a HFT investment process then, or kind of a fund, would you say, how much would you say the typical fund's kind of value add proposition rests in technology or the kind of technology they use or how they use it versus kind of investment insight or kind of financial modeling or that kind of stuff?
That's a great question. I always feel like, you know, technology is kind of a means to an end. So like you could have the best, fastest technology, but if you don't have the right team, you don't have the right strategies to put into that technology, you're pretty much screwed at the end of the day. So for us, it's like, I think in this industry, you know, everyone, there's always that myth of like trying to, what is it that we're always playing the hardware game of like buying the fastest servers and making sure that we're like number one all the time and, you know, doing whatever they portrayed in the Hummingbird project when they're blasting holes through mountains and under wiring under rivers and that kind of stuff. Like we're not doing any of the wiring because I, you know, I say this over and over again, but the fastest routes between a lot of these venues today, they're owned by vendors, not by like private companies. And so I pay the same vendor the same price and I get the same really fast speeds as everybody else. And so, so that's been great. It's helped to democratize and really, even out the industry. So I would say that the race to zero is, you know, it's pretty much over, you know, these days in terms of we can be, every company has a definition of what's fast enough for them. You know, for us, it's still insanely fast, but we're not going to be, we don't want to be like the number one. We don't have to be the number one fastest and spend an additional couple million to be number one when I could spend that couple million on hiring better researchers to, you know, make internal processes faster, other things faster or better or whatever it is, be more creative, you know. So you're absolutely right. Like I think these days it's becoming more about, you know, how creative can I get with the strategies? What type of people do we have on the team? Can we, you know, come up with different things and also, you know, keep up with the newest technologies and stuff like that as well. So, but yeah, absolutely. People don't really consider the other factors of the human aspects and things like that. Yeah.
Well, which I think is a really interesting and a very, very powerful point is that I think there's a maturation of an industry, right, at play here, and exactly what you're saying, which is that at the beginning, you know, not everybody has the data, then everybody gets the data, then not everybody has the processing power, then everybody gets the processing power, and then everybody has the cable going into the I don't know, trading platform, as you say. Now everybody has the cable going to the trading platform. And now it becomes about, you know, pure, you know, intellectual or kind of, I suppose, different kinds of competitive spheres where you have to build your own proprietary model. And of course, you're not going to share that, so therefore you'll only be yours. And on that aspect, you can continue to compete. So this idea of, I suppose, the kind of pattern recognition. So is it the case that with HFT as a field of endeavor, because the time scales are so small, that, you know, when I say financial modeling, really what I should have said is statistical modeling for these set of problems. Because I think one of the other perceptions, certainly, people that deal with, let's say, company information, fundamental information have is that, well, in the HFT space, you basically dismiss all of that and you kind of don't care and you only ever deal with PT or price at time T or some information up to that point. And so therefore, you're just kind of trying to find trading pattern, flow patterns and all these kinds of different very kind of mechanical patterns of how blood or trading money flows through this system called, you know, an equity market or a bond market or a commodity market. And you're just trying to kind of nitpick at the system around the edges. I mean, is that preconception roughly true, or would you say it's completely off base?
Oh yeah, that is, you know, pretty roughly true in terms of like, do we need a lot of alternative data to survive? You know, the answer is actually no. You know, we don't need to have that many vendors for alternative data. But I think for us as a company, so I think it varies between company to company. I think most of us still kind of use a little bit of other types of data, like alternative data, you know, metadata, whatever it may be. We still need dates, you know, we still need things like holiday, you know, calendars, things like that. No bank calendars, knowing like what's going on there. We still do like to make sure, like, we know economically if there's any large announcements going on or anything like that. You know, that's definitely still relevant. Will it absolutely kill us if we don't have that information? I don't know. but I think it's just beneficial as a company to make sure that we still kind of know what's going on out there in the world so that we can still prepare for, you know, what's about to come.
Because I think what's interesting for me is I kind of read all these articles about a class of algorithm called the recurrent neural networks, RNNs.
Right.
And, you know, the wonderful thing about that is application outside of finance is that you can basically have these kind of very stylized worlds in computer games or board games or whatever, and you're trying to solve a very kind of mechanical problem of forecasting, you know, through these kind of strategic tools. When I say mechanical, I mean that the parameters are known of the system essentially, and then that you're kind of working with a number of uncertainties. Those uncertainties are very deep, but at least you kind of understand them. There's been a lot of kind of evolution in that space from obviously the Go successes, but also now much more to cooperative, coordinative games, strategic games, etc. And right. I always thought that that was a very appealing way to think about financial markets, if only you could actually impact the outcome. Because one of the RNNs is the important part is that your actions impact the reaction. And so you're kind of, you know, ping-ponging back and forth. And if you're kind of a fundamental trader, whether you put a $100 million trade or not, it doesn't really matter. It doesn't move the price at all. Whereas it feels to me like in this space, certainly in some asset classes, you could absolutely play this kind of RNN type models with the view that you're kind of impacting the price or you're kind of competing against another. If you're competing with another HFT, for example, or if your counterpart is a, I don't know, a passive or an ETF player, then I'm guessing those rules would be quite different. I mean, when you create these models, do you have a mental image of who you're trading up against? Is it the case of another sort of a intelligent, high frequency, a price seeker? Or is it more of a kind of a slightly more, idiosyncratic or somewhat other motivated agent, like a ETF rebalance kind of person?
Right. It depends on the strategy, right? So I think most HFT firms, like, we need to have not just like one large strategy to rely on, but rather, you know, we might have a bunch of different strategies with a bunch of different sub-signals underneath that. And that could be in the hundreds, you know, pretty large for a small company. So we might have multiple things to rely on. And some of them we expect to trade against large banks. And then some of them we expect to trade against high frequency traders. Rarely do we look at retail stuff, actually. So we don't buy order flow or anything like that. So, for us, like that's kind of the realm that we're currently, you know, operating in. It's interesting that you mentioned, like, you know, things like a game, like a board game, for instance, or how it works in chess when one movement kind of affects the other. You know, it's interesting because it felt like we've seen, you know, in that space, like AI has been very successful, right? In terms of beating the number one chess players, beating the number one Go player. He just, you know, he quit because he said AI is just too smart for him. And which is really unfortunate because it's like the number one Go player in the world quitting because of AI, right? And getting totally bummed out by that. But the thing is, the reason why AI has been so good at that is because it's a very set game with limited set of rules. It's a closed off world. You know, the rules aren't going to be evolving or changing anytime soon. And so, and there's thousands of years of history for this game. They could back test based on thousands of years of information, which is really awesome. In finance, oh, it's totally different because the rules are changing in the industry constantly. Different markets are changing. Different rules are going to be established all the time, you know, and there's a lot of unknowns. So there's always new players entering the markets. There's always new strategies coming around. And so that's the reason why strategies die over time. You know, any kind of AI that you come up with in the industry will probably die at some point in time just because there's going to be smarter people out there with new rules and new information that you didn't have back then. The information's evolving. And so, you know, you can't just backtest. It's hard to backtest off of many years of information also because, you know, the information is different. So it changes over time. Those for all those different reasons, you know, we see things like, I know IBM Watson, they have an ETF, right? And, you know, it's an AI-powered ETF. Like, I think the world's first AI-powered one. And, you know, it's supposed to be a cool innovation. I mean, you know, I don't know how much money Watson spent on working on this kind of stuff, but clearly it was a big endeavor that costs a lot of money. And you look at its performance today, I don't think it's beating. Is it beating the S&P? I don't think it's actually doing quite well today.
Well, it's very hard to say. Look, it's I think if the ETF sat on a Jeopardy board, it would win really well. So that's great. But as you say, I think the application of these sciences into financial services is not linear. Like, you can't take from one model and put it next. There's all sorts of other problems there. But I want to sort of ask you to clarify one of the questions. So I think in sort of general quantitative sciences, you know that the world is changing. You know that your strategies are kind of have a half-life themselves. And I suppose some of the industry clings onto this idea of an arbitrage pricing theory. So this kind of notion that you forever get paid for holding a certain type of risk. And so they'll say, oh, don't worry about the next year if it doesn't work. Don't worry about the year after that doesn't work. We just wait for the next 100 years and it'll work on average. And maybe for some strategies, they have that luxury to be able to wait and so forth. But I suppose the same way of viewing a different way of viewing the same problem would be to say, actually, as you say, these strategies are just, you know, not relevant today, right? So value, for example, is just not relevant today. It might be relevant some point in the future, but it's just not relevant, and for a while it won't be relevant. So in the HFT world, if I create 100 signals, for argument's sake, so I've kind of spent some time, I've created 100 legit signals that work today for whatever reason, how many of those signals should I expect are still roughly functional? Like, what percentage of that? Is it 80? Is it 50 in like a year or 2 years' time? I know this is kind of a how long is a piece of string kind of question, but I'm just trying to get a sense for how fast is the attrition rate for models in that world.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it really depends on the company. And so for high frequency trading, it's hard to speak for other firms just because they all have different teams who focus on certain types of, you know, some might do market making, some might do set arb in the industry, and they could all last different amounts of time based on, you know, what types of opportunities, whether it's emerging markets or, you know, really developed markets, or whether it's equities or futures or, you know, whatever they're trading. It does vary a little bit. I would say over here, like, it really varies on our end as well. Like, we've had some strategies that, you know, do really, really well and then just kind of die off within a couple of weeks. And we're like, oh, great, you know. And then we've had some that last for a year, you know? And have been reliable over years. We might have to make some tweaks over time and constantly revise them, but they've been pretty reliable over the last couple of years or so. So it's kind of all over the place. I'm trying to think of examples of when things just kind of, you know, when you kind of know when something's just, you know, completely not working, and then you have to go back and revise it. I mean, it happens a lot more than you would expect. And it's something like when you're starting a hedge fund, it's something that no one really kind of, allocates any time for, I guess. Like, everyone thinks, you know, they're going to lose the fund, it's going to be a success. No one thinks about, what if my strategy fails, which is what happens 99% of the time. What if the one I just launched, you know, fails and I'm not going to do very well? Like, are these investors going to give me a chance when, you know, we just launched and we're immediately down and not doing so well.
Which happens all the time. I think we have the worst timing ever.
It happens all the time. And unfortunately, there's also cycles in the industry too, where no matter what you do, you know, you're just not going to do very well, right? So quant, I think, you know, quant has been in kind of a down cycle recently. And they're doing really well a couple of years ago. And then now a lot of the big quant firms here in Boston and New York and stuff, they've had their worst year in like a decade, which is unfortunate. A lot of them have had their worst year for some time, and it happens, you know, and I'm sure they'll continue to revise and maybe hire some new people and change their strategies, change whatever patterns they've been looking at. And, you know, that it's all about the competition in the industry is kind of pulling a lot of them out.
Don't worry, they'll just wait it out. It's a risk premium. So it'll come good eventually. But I think, you know, it's kind of should be common knowledge, right? That anytime that quant funds or indeed fundamental funds underperform, it was the high frequency guys that took their lunch, right? So, you guys still get the boogeyman kind of approach there. Oh, they must have done it. Somehow they've arbitraged out value or something. But I think the reason I said it's really interesting because some of the guests I've had on this podcast have, sort of had the view that alternative risk premia is just a myth. It's a story. It's a way to get people to continue to invest in very low information, high risk strategies that maybe have kind of a long-term drift to them, but essentially they're kind of so variable that it's almost impossible to tell whether they're going to work or not over the next 1, 2, 3, even 5 years. And so this idea that it allows people to create these strategies and hang on to them for a very long period of time, rather than perhaps the alternative point of view, which I think you just expressed, which basically says that you monitor your strategies all the time, and when they stop working is when it's time to revise them or move them. So you don't kind of keep them around just because, hey, I told my investors that I'm going to be doing this particular type of strategy. But in that case, I mean, I'm just wondering, what are the challenges with any kind of quantitative framework is the communication to non-technical clients when you're trying to explain to them the difference between skill and random probability?
So you're trying to say, that's a big topic
I think it's really vital for our industry collectively to become more kind of embracing of scientific methods, right? Whether that's high frequency or not or whatever else, right? So this notion that, you know, the world is highly uncertain and that we are just trying to marginally eke out a little bit of advantage, and that little bit of advantage leads to some returns, but it's a tiny advantage. Opposed to if you listen to the financial press, you get the impression that the world is extremely certain, that people understand really well what will happen in terms of economic cycles or whether a price of a stock is low or high or whatever, because that's the way that this industry talks about itself, the way that it kind of confirms trust or kind of relies upon people to invest money into it. So I'm just wondering, when in a high frequency space, I mean, how does that conversation go? Because in the long only quant space, I suppose you have the conversation by saying, look, we understand the fundamentals and that's what we're anchored to, and that's what you believe in, that's what I believe in, so therefore, don't worry, let's just wait it out. This is just random. So we have skill, but this is just random, it's happening. What does the anchor look like in the space of much more kind of technical or high frequency funds?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, you know, the key for us in terms of dealing with investors in the high frequency space, it's all about having good communication, I feel like, and setting the right expectations. You know, if I tell an investor we're going to be up, we'll be up 10% this month, they're going to expect that, you know, and they're going to hold you to it. And if you're not up 10%, if you're up 9 or 8%, you know, well, that's fine. But if you're up 5%, you know, then that's bad, actually. So, you know, they're going to hold it against you. And we've had a lot of those types of instances happen. And so we've learned to make sure we've been very mathematical with our predictions. We've been very, and also very conservative, you know, with what we're expecting all the time. So that we always try to, you know, beat whatever they're expecting. But you're absolutely right. Like, you know, we've had some bad months of trading. And during those bad months, what do? Well, you know, we make sure we communicate to the investors and, you know, we just tell them exactly what's going on. We actually increase the communication levels with our investors during our bad months, whereas most people might run away and, you know, stay away from that. And so, you know, but doing that, I think, you know, a lot of the way, because we're structured as a hedge fund, you know, that the hedge fund ultimately doesn't matter how good or bad you do. If your investors pull out, you know, you're screwed. You don't have a business anymore. So our goal is to always make sure like we keep the communication channels open with our investors, no matter what the conditions are, and to make sure that they understand that they're in it for the long run and that we keep on telling them and convincing them that, you know, no matter what happens, we've gone through these cycles before and we'll continue to go through cycles again. And that's really helped us, I think, during our worst days as well, when everyone's like calling us up and being like, what's going on? You know, it really helps a lot to just be transparent about things and let them know what's happening and why it happened and move on from there. So, in our kind of business as well, you know, talking about strategies and revising stuff, like we have to revise our strategies constantly, you know, because you never know what happens out there. So, but absolutely, it's such an interesting topic because people don't think about that either on the communication, on the human side of things. Like if you don't keep trust with your clients and don't establish that sense of trust, you know, we know what we're doing and that professional level of communication, then, you know, it's harder to basically run a business especially during bad years when, you know, things don't go the way that you want them to go.
Completely. And I think that's the question of why, I think you just kind of put it in there. And that's a really interesting point as well, because obviously with random outcomes, whether that's a factor portfolio or whether that's a fundamental manager, whether it's a high frequency trader, often you don't have a very human sounding why. You kind of have it was a random draw, or lightning struck, or, you know, it got cloudy today or something like that. And so the language that we have is really tricky for this. And I think for me, for example, this is a kind of one of those pivotal questions of how do you reason with somebody who reasons by induction, so kind of from example to generalization. So I met my mate Joey yesterday. He told me such and such was true, so therefore it must be true, versus deduction. Oh, we've run this over a number of strategies, a number of different things. Statistically, it's got a 52% hit rate. So therefore, statistically speaking, this particular fund or this particular strategy therefore should do X, Y, Z, but today it didn't. Today, the 48 came in or something like that, right? And in that moment, people go, okay, so it shouldn't come in too often, right? So if it happens 3 more times, then maybe it's not the right probability distribution. And you're like, no. It can come in 10,000 more times and it might still be the probability distribution, the 58. So I guess, suppose, how do you make these stories human, or do you kind of rely upon your clientele having a certain level of technical aptitude and understanding?
That's a good question as well. One thing we've learned the hard way is that we need to make sure that our clients have some technical knowledge of our business. And the biggest reason why is because, we don't want people who've just read Flash Boys and decided they love hype. Some people are crazy. They decide, oh, I love hybrid trading. I want to invest in HFT. And then, they come in and then they have no idea what to expect and think that we're going to be, making billions of dollars every single day and that, that kind of stuff. And it just doesn't happen. And so, absolutely, a lot of our clients, if they've invested in other funds, usually that's a really good sign. other kind of quant funds or high frequency funds, usually that's one of the few things that we do look for, in our clients when we do reverse due diligence on them. So,
now that's good. That's good to hear that you guys do that. No, because I completely agree. I think there should be some two-way self-selection. I think the industry is so competitive at the moment that there's such a drive to get assets that most strategies, I suppose, will be happy to accept money if it's coming in, right? I mean, they're going to push back money based on the wrong client. So let me ask you another question, and this relates to communication, but maybe the non-technical side now for a second. So we talked about this in a kind of a humorous way the other time, but the fact that, you're a woman in a sort of a man's world, this is a terrible cliche quote, but this idea that financial services or asset management is still mostly male-dominated, especially the hedge fund world has this kind of a male ego thing attached to it, maybe historically, maybe not so much now. So I suppose what I want to find is have your experiences been, so I suppose women who are in this industry who are thinking of either starting funds or working in quantitative sciences, it's fantastic to see that there is more, but they are still a very low percentage overall. And so what are your thoughts around this kind of subject? I mean, what have been your experiences in this area?
Interesting. It's always, I don't know. I don't wake up every morning being like, oh, I'm a woman, woe is me.
I do.
I really have situations where I come and think about it all the time. The only times it happens is when I've had some situations where, like, for instance, we're interviewing a potential board member or potential employee in the final round. And, we really like them and everything's been great. And they come in and they're like, oh yeah, how did you kids get here today? They'll call me a kid or something like that. That happens a lot. It's not really even a woman thing, but they'll just be like, how are you kids are, doing this interesting stuff. Like, how did you kids get here? I'm like, and this guy's like 70 years. I mean, okay. He might be, I would say like mid 40s maybe. And they'll come in and call me a kid, which is, I'm like, okay, fine. I'm the age of your kids. Maybe I don't think I'd be the age of their kids. I think it's just that I look like a kid, that they'll come in and call me a kid. And then it's a little bit strange because it's like, I'm interviewing them for final round here. And, you could call me.
Have you ever played with that? Have you ever played with that and said, yeah, I might just be the intern, but I'm going to ask you some questions about, your experiences and stuff and just see how they react.
I've learned to just be like, thanks, Dad. And they'll be like, what? And it'll catch them off guard, like, but I'm like, yeah, if you call me a kid, then I'll call you Dad. I'll call, whatever you call me, I'll call you the other thing back, the opposite of that. So,
because I think we talked about this idea that, yeah, because I suppose you have a youthful complexion. Let's say you kind of get mistaken for waitresses and various other of help staff.
That happens all the time. Like, it's a common thing where, what was it again? I've been let's see, the last time it happened was actually at the airport, in the airport lounge. You know, it happens all the time. I'm like in some airport lounge and, you know, some lady like, excuse me, ma'am, you take my plates. I get that all the time. But that's not even a hedge fund thing. That's just in this industry thing. If I'm wearing black, like, you know, you can expect to get called to the kitchen, you know, if you're wearing black. You're an Asian, that's an Asian woman, maybe. But anyway, it happens, you know, and I have to learn to like use humor, you know, like it's a, what do you call it? Cognitive biases. It happens because of that reinforcement learning, right? You're reinforced with something like, I have biases too. And we all have biases, and you just have to learn, like, I can't control their biases. You know, they've seen a lot of Asian women being waiters. My parents were waiters. So they kind of reinforce that stereotype. And then over time they thought I'm a waiter too. My cognitive bias is that I feel like Asian women are bad drivers, you know, because I was a bad driver. My mom's a bad driver. And then every time now I get a female Uber driver, I'm like, oh, she must be a bad driver too. And the thing is, like, so long as I give her a chance and I let her, you know, I make sure to go in there with an open mind and be like, I know this bias exists. I'm going to open my mind up and not get annoyed and, you know, make sure that I don't feel like, you know, negative feelings every time. And chances are they always prove me wrong that, you know, they're great drivers. They're great. And so, so same with in this industry as well, like people are used to, you know, I tend to be like, you know, I speak a lot, so they'll be like, oh, you know, Christina's a keynote speech or whatever, but people usually don't believe it. They'll be like, oh, you know, are you the waiter? Are you the, you know, are you the intern? I've gotten someone who asked me, are you in high school or in college? And I'm on the board of directors. I'm the chair of the board of the organization that was hosting the event. And the, you know, this lady attends the event, doesn't even know that I'm the one who organized it. And it's like, are you in high school? I'm like, yeah, I'm in high school. You know, so the good news, the silver lining is that people have very low expectations of you. I can just be like, oh, I'm not in high school. I actually graduated from college. I'm working in the industry. And they'll be like, wow, congrats. You know, so the expectation is super low.
It is absolutely fascinating. I think you're right. It's not just necessarily a industry thing in our banking, but it is a society thing, and obviously it's quite different in different countries as well. What is really interesting about the whole point about the perception thing is, we talk a lot about democratization of quant and finance, and we talk about this idea of scientific method, right? So on the one hand, we kind of conclude that the brain or IQ or ability or systems thinking is really what determines success and what kind of works. And I think there is certainly a large number of people who work from very technical backgrounds who hold that belief at the core of their work and what they do and what they think has a value add. And I suppose there's a sort of another element that we've identified, which is a societal neighborhood or background to all of this, which requires communication, soft skills, requires all sorts of engagement with the external world. And I suppose what's interesting or kind of unusual is there are all sorts of stereotypes around finance, asset management, and so forth. I remember there was a period after 2008 where, you know, it was bad to say that you're a banker or that you worked in finance in London. I mean, it was really not a good thing to say. People ask you, what do you do? And you're like, I'm a poet. I write poetry. Yeah. And you kind of sit there with your suit saying that. I mean, it was just, you know, it's absurd. Where I think it's for I suppose, voices like yours to be coming out of what is deemed to be the kind of basement of highly technology-driven asset, you know, asset management, the idea. I mean, as you said before, very few of the leaders of this space are out there on Bloomberg and CNBC being charismatic and interacting with people. They're kind of hitting in the background, right? I mean,
yeah, absolutely. Oh, we definitely feel the same way about, you know, just... It's tough because I would tell, the biggest piece of advice I give to other high frequency folks is like, you know, you got to go out there more and you got to talk to the public, because if you don't, then the public and the media will spin their own story about you, you know, and chances are it's going to be really bad. And at this point in this industry, you know, there's no point in keeping secrets. Like, you know, of course, every company has a secret sauce or whatever it is that they, you know, proprietary stuff that they're not going to talk about, but you can go out there and say general stuff about the industry, about what you're actually doing, about where the industry is going to go, you know, trends, whatever it may be. You can definitely, you should talk about that. That's your responsibility. And so, we try to make sure that, you know, not just us, but also other folks out there can really start to talk and be more vocal about what we're actually doing. Because right now it's only,
there's only like, you know, 5 or 6 people who will ever want to talk about high frequency trading out there. There's really not a lot of like, I would say like CEO type folks in our space who will, you know, be willing to talk to like a reporter, for instance.
No, exactly. And I think unfortunately there is a kind of a loop that is created around this whole idea. And this is where I start to get a little bit concerned also about some of the major concerns about AI or about, I suppose, the adoption of AI in society is one of scale, but it's also one about control. So this idea that people think that these systems are going to get out of control, that the way that they are executing their logic is either directly harmful or interacts with something else and becomes directly harmful to the underlying cause. So the idea that, for example, if I'm using an automated assistant who books my restaurant and it books me a restaurant for 6 p.m. for my lunch appointment, that's funny and I can joke about that and I can rearrange that. But if there's 600,000 bookings made to the same restaurants for, you know, 6 p.m. lunch, then it becomes much less funny, especially for the restaurant. So I think it's you know, HFT, you know, some of the early question marks around it was really around this notion of, is it good for microstructure? Is it good for price discovery? Do we feel like this is the right way to set prices? And of course, you know, the regulatory and the general media story of that was, well, we don't quite know. I think the jury's out. We don't know what those kind of people are doing in their space. They might be liquidity providers. They may be very conditional liquidity providers. We just don't know. And therefore, we feel uneasy because there's all these algorithms running around trading things that we don't quite have a human story for. And I suppose the AI is a very similar type of argument, right? Where people go like, well, these algorithms are out there doing stuff. We don't quite understand because it's technical or it happens at a very fast speed or something else that puts it out of our realm of control or understanding. And what I'm glad to hear from you and confirm that this is right is that HFT's kind of moved beyond that type of Wild West sort of mentality or not mentality, sorry, well, perception, because we yet to confirm what actually was happening inside, to a much more kind of institutionalized and kind of, you know, steady as she goes, research driven type of businesses.
Yeah, to an extent, right? You're absolutely right. Like some folks will, you know, I guess it depends on the types of perceptions. It varies by country as well. And there's certain HFT firms in different countries that, you know, I might not know about, or countries that, you know, barely, some countries don't even have the infrastructure to kind of do that kind of stuff yet. There's no microwave towers or anything like that in certain areas of the world, you know, so it just really varies depending on where you go. But you're absolutely right that the industry's changed quite a lot in recent years, especially, you know, after Flash Boys came out and it became really hyped up for a little bit and then it's kind of just died down. And now, you know, what people worry about, all the hype and talk in the industry, actually, I would say 2 years ago, all the hype and talk was about cryptocurrencies instead. And so I would go to the same conferences and I would present. People would be like, oh, you guys are the old dinosaurs now. And they look at the crypto funds and they're like, now they're the new young guys, you know, in the industry. And I'm like, okay, you know, and then 2 years later, now the crypto stuff has pretty much all died out. A lot of them have. And there's a few that have been doing okay, you know, that have still been around. But again, it's the same kind of cycle. All these industries go through these cycles of different exciting things. You know, who knows what's next? Maybe one day everyone talks about quantum computing and there still hasn't yet been any successful case of quantum computing yet, but maybe give it a couple years. Maybe that's the new hype, you know, that comes out.
Oh, that is absolutely the new hype. I mean, I have read research papers on this, Christina. There are research papers out there saying we've used quantum computing to solve this optimization problem.
That's awesome.
It is, if it's kind of, I don't even know how to read it. Like, I mean, the math is different or the whole setup is different, right? So I think if we think that, I don't know, HFT or quant or AI is a bit technical or kind of, you know, it's getting you know, to the edge of our understanding, the quantum hype cycle is just, you know, going to be incredibly difficult to understand if someone's actually telling, you know, legit stuff or not.
Give it a couple years, you know, and we'll see. And you're absolutely right on the topic of discussing whether HFT is good or bad for society as a whole. I think it also warrants a discussion of, we should, you know, talk about capitalism as a framework as a whole, because, you know, if the purpose of, you know, what's the purpose of a company like Goldman Sachs? It's not to make a bunch of money. They're not a charity. You know, we're not a charity either. Same with any other for-profit company in the world. You know, none of Google, Apple, Facebook, you know, they're all there to make money and sell your data at the end of the day. So that brings up other questions that are a lot deeper that I'm no scholar in, but it's stuff that I do think about quite often. You know, of course, we're not a charity, but can we, you know, do good for the world in other ways? You know, people argue in high frequency, yeah, you're right, you know, liquidity providing, and it's driven down fees a lot in recent years. You can, you know, tell the fees have gotten a lot lower, which is great. And it's also a lot of innovations coming from HFT have kind of, you know, gone into the rest of the industry now. And so whether you're a quant or even a discretionary team, we've had some discretionary teams who will adopt a lot of some of the AI models. They're not going to be the ones coding it, but, you know, they could still use some of those types of technologies on their daily job. And so we've seen a lot of those instances of like, hey, this came from HFT a long time ago, and now, you know, it's useful to these non-quantitative teams as well. So, but anyway, it's a longer discussion because, you know, when it comes to whether or not we should be a capitalist society or a socialist or, you know, whatever the framework people try to argue for, right, that's a longer, broader economic discussion that is, you know, I am no expert at it. So, you know, take everything I say with a grain of salt.
No, but I think that's brilliant, right? Because you were talking about your favorite book earlier. So one of my books that I really enjoyed reading recently, which is recommended by a colleague, is a book called Debt by David Graeber. And I might get David on the podcast at some point. But the reason I really enjoy this book is because it gives a context as to how debt or debt contracts have worked throughout history. And for me, what it really highlighted, it's a very thick book, it's really dense, it's really good, is just the different ways that society can be set up and that, you know, it can function well and it can have a cooperative, coordinated efforts. We don't need to swing between socialism and capitalism being the only two pillars that we kind of go, and then we all kind of decide, actually, we don't quite like either one in extremes, so we kind of want somewhere in the middle, but where in the middle is really where most countries are kind of gliding around. But this idea that the way that money is treated and used in society, et cetera, can be very different. But as you say, it's a huge conversation, but it's definitely one that is, I think, also ironically coming up on our radar as we start to make enough things to survive globally as a race. And now the question is really about distribution and what we know, right, and happiness and all that kind of stuff. And so capitalism might have got us here. That might have been really good exuberance, teenage exuberance energy to get us to this level. But, you know, not all aspects of it necessarily are useful going forward or a very modified way, perhaps. And just to kind of put us into that very final question, the last stretch of the podcast. So my very last question, and I'm guessing this is kind of links in with what you just said as well, but in terms of AI and its kind of adoption in society, so in a broader picture outside of financial services, what do you see as the biggest opportunity or threat that AI presents to society or the human race?
It's a really interesting question. Wow. I would say there's just so many opportunities in terms of jobs in this space that's fueled by AI, actually. Everyone says, oh, AI takes away your job. There's articles about AI automating away a lot of manual work, a lot of manual jobs. But in reality, if you've seen those studies on like the World Economic Forum, they published a study on AI, and they said, you know, AI has created actually a lot of new jobs that are really interesting, and it will, you know, help us with sustaining the future of a variety of different industries. So I'm trying to think of, like, for instance, you know, the job title of data scientist, right? 10 years ago, if I said I'm a data scientist, people are like, what are you talking about? You know, today you look at how common and frequent that job title is. It's everywhere. I have a ton of friends who are working in data science. And as a major, you know, it's become like a major in certain universities. You can actually study data science as a specific academic course, which is really cool. So there's actually a lot of new jobs that have been created around the topics of fintech, data science, AI that traditionally, you know, didn't exist, you know, 8 or 9 years ago even. So that, I think, to me is what's really exciting, is we're really at the frontier of, you know, the future of a variety of different industries, not just in finance, but, you know, pretty much everything being automated. And that's great. I mean, if there was no evolution in the industry of jobs, right, we'd all be farmers today. But the fact is that there's been evolution of different jobs. You know, farmers have, you know, industrial revolution happen and everything else. And, you know, now we're in this kind of AI revolution. And that's great. You know, it's another kind of one step hopefully forward in society. But with every revolution, there's risks. You know, with the Industrial Revolution, we had child labor. We had people killing, accidentally getting killed with machines and stuff like that. Same with AI, there's always going to be, AI is discriminatory right now. You know, they've shown, Microsoft and a bunch of other AI tools, like they couldn't detect black faces. They couldn't detect, they would go against whenever those AI, some people use AI to do try to get loans and stuff like that. And they've shown that women have, really bad luck with AI stuff whenever they use AI to determine how much of a loan or what credit score, whatever else to give women. That kind of stuff happens as well. So there's a lot of discrimination that results. But I do believe that over time, all of that hopefully will get better with time. It's just that we're at such an early stage now that there just needs to be a lot of work done there. You know, same with the Industrial Revolution back then, machines weren't safe. And now, there's a lot of safety checks, a lot of different things surrounding that, a lot of laws that have been implemented to prevent child labor and all that kind of other, all the bad stuff, basically. So I think the same thing will happen. There's a lot of great opportunities. And, I would prefer to be optimistic rather than, going home scared that I'm losing my job, right? If I am ever scared, I would go back to school and get an education again and take one of those data science courses, take a coding course or whatever, right? And then get back to the market, because there's just so much exciting stuff out there that, it's great to kind of stay on top of things. Yeah.
100% agree. And I think this idea that there's change, I think, is probably the only constant that we know of. But I just had a funny thought while you were describing that, and it's kind of a cruel thought as well in some ways, is that, some of the bias that we see in algorithms, some of which is the way that it uses the data, but some of it also comes from the labeling of the data underlyingly. So this notion that people kind of point to a picture of someone and say, that's probably a waitress. I was going to say, I don't think AI is going to work for you, Christina. I think it's going to be.
There's a website that labels you. I don't know. I forgot the name of it. There's a website that you can click on where you upload a photo of yourself, and it will use AI to label you based on what it thinks you are. And the purpose of the website was to show that, people discriminate and stuff. So sometimes they'll put some really discriminatory words against, you can upload your photo and they'll, they might think you're a certain sexual orientation. They might think that you're a certain age group or that you're a certain profession just based on what your face looks like. That's becoming like a weird thing.
I tried this out with my son. I have two boys, but one of them was wearing a costume. It's like a knightly costume, I suppose. And it said the description was king. So he's very happy with that. And he took that away as the defining characteristic. He's now the king. But listen, thank you very, very much for the time today, Christina. It's been really interesting to delve into this world and find out a bit more about you as well.
Yeah, thank you, Michael. It's great to be on this podcast. I really appreciate it. And I hope you guys all enjoyed.